Very happy to welcome in Bob Trippi. He's director of research for this show, a role that he takes seriously. He's a longtime State of Michigan sports writer. He's our number one numbers cruncher, captain database. Busy day for you yesterday. It's always a busy day for you when sports are going on, right?
Yeah, that's for sure. It was quite the day in terms of, you know, what to follow. You know, it started out with the Tigers and the White Sox. Then I'm flipping back and forth watching the Detroit Grand Prix. I wanted to see how that was going to unfold. And
yeah,
then wrapped it up at night by watching, the NBA Finals Game 2. So it was quite the day and well-rounded, so to speak. The only thing I was missing was the Stanley Cup Finals, but I get that tonight. So, it's quite a different range of emotions with each one of those, you know, considering. I mean, the Tigers, what a mess. Then you had the Detroit Grand Prix, which, you know, I used to cover when it was downtown doing Formula One and when they were out on Belle Isle. And this year, you know, I didn't do that. Just, you know, I had a chance to see them on Saturday just to see what it's all about.
Spent a lot of time at MIS, too, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't know how many races I did there. Going back to, like, 85, I think, was my first race.
Right.
So, and then, you know, wrapped it up at night by watching an unbelievable game, to say the least. You know, it was just like a roller coaster, you know, the way it all turned out. So, quite a day, to say the least. You know, it makes me wonder what's going to happen tonight with the Golden Knights and the Panthers. So, time of year I actually like, you know, not as much as fall when football happens. So,
right.
I think
June is still there's quite a bit going on. We've got the playoffs coming to an end in both sports. We've got the end of the Triple Crown races. We've got the U.S. Open in golf. We've got the NBA draft. We've got enough going. I think July is the slowest month. It's the hardest month to do this show. And it's maybe, if you're a sports fan, the best time to go trout fishing or backpacking or whatever else you want to do to get away. But for right now, I was going to ask you, Bob, how many fans do you think there are? What percent that are watching everything they can get? They're watching all the NBA Finals, and they'll watch all the Stanley Cup Final games. What percent are only watching basketball because they don't like hockey, they don't understand it, puck's too small, whatever the reason is? And what percent are hockey snobs who really don't like basketball for whatever reason? And there's a division there. But how many people do you think are going to be glued to Game 2 tonight in Vegas the same way they were to Game 2 last night in Denver?
Oh, it's going to be a dramatic drop-off. The NHL just does not draw in terms of the audiences on TV. I mean, look at last night. It was on ABC. What do you got it on tonight? It's on TNT. I don't know what their ratings were for the first game, but my guess is there'll be a huge drop off, and you might see a rating of maybe a one or a two, you know, compared to what I think I read that game one of the NBA Finals, they drew what, 10 million viewers or something like that. If they get 2 million for the NHL, I'll be totally shocked. You know, I think the only people that are probably going to be watching it are those in Vegas and those in Florida, you know, in the Miami area, because I just don't think people are thinking hockey. You know, it's also about the super draw of, you know, watching. And right now, who's the superstar for either the Golden Knights or for, you know, the Panthers? And, you know, whereas you look at the NBA, you got a Jokic and you got Butler, and you can name a few other players, Jamal Murray. But there's quite a drop-off, you know, as far as audiences. And that's why they're not on ABC tonight or, you know, some other major network other than TNT.
Yeah, and the NHL has been on the networks in the past. The major networks has been on NBC for a long time, but with the new contracts, and you know, TNT is good enough to carry the Western Conference, or excuse me, the Eastern Conference finals in basketball. So it's, you know, it's not like it's buried somewhere on you know, some channel that you need a special subscription to get. But in terms of what you see with the audience tonight, I'm really curious how many people outside those markets, as you say, know any of the players. Maybe they've heard of a player or two. But in basketball, I think the casual fans would know who Joker was. They would know who Jimmy Butler was. There'll be people tuning in tonight that won't be able to name more than a player or two on either team.
Well, exactly. You know, it's, and you know, it's kind of unfortunate. You know, you got two goalies that were two of the top goalies in the league by save percentage, and Adin Hill and Sergei Bobrovsky. Yes. And you know, if you watched any of the Panthers, and I did, you know, I kind of got a little bit interested in them as after they beat Boston. Sorry, Rob. Anyways, you know, they play a different style of hockey, and I thought, you know, they're a little aggressive in a sense. With Kachuk, being
a little
ejected
trouble,
from the game.
Rob, with the line here.
How long now? Is it better?
A little bit better now? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, the other night, you know, one of the best players on the ice, Kachuk, got ejected from the game. And they, you know, the Panthers, I do like the Panthers. And the reason I like the Panthers is because of the style of hockey that they play. They got a decent goalie. And they play a very aggressive style of hockey, which I like, versus the Golden Knights. You know, there's a lot of pomp and, you know, pageantry and all that stuff with the big game. And they've got some talent on that team. You know, Eichel, who plays for the Golden Knights, used to play for the Buffalo Sabres, and he was traded to the Golden Knights. So it's a very interesting concept here because you got two teams from not very strong areas for TV audiences. And today, you know, I actually was out there looking to see what was being written about them. And, you know, they're saying a lot of people are trying to dump their tickets for tonight's game, you know, out in Vegas, which I thought was kind of unusual. They said some people were finding that people were not, you know, the interest is gone. After game one, the interest is gone. So I do expect Florida to come back tonight and play a much better game. And I'll be
shocked
if it's not.
Well, it was 2-2 after two periods, right? And then didn't Vegas score three times in the last period? Florida actually had the lead.
Yes. Yeah, well, you got to remember this. A couple of years ago when Vegas was in the Stanley Cup Finals, they were playing the Washington Capitals, and they won the first game. Then after that, Washington won four in a row and actually won it on Vegas ice. So, you know, Vegas better hope that Florida doesn't, you know, straighten things out here because it's going to be very tough for them, especially if you know, Florida ends up winning tonight, going back to Florida, which is, you know, a very hard place to play. And, you know, we'll be facing a possibly a 3-1 deficit going back to Vegas, you know, for game five. So
there are good storylines here both ways, Bob. Obviously, if the Panthers, an 8 seed, who did they beat in the first round? I don't remember. Oh, that was Boston. That's right. sorry, Rob. If you look at the idea that you have 2 8 seeds in basketball and hockey from South Florida, about 40 minutes apart, and it would be amazing to think that 2 8 seeds are in the finals, but here they are both with the chance to win, and, you know, you could make a short drive in an hour. You're from one arena to the other. And then for the Golden Knights, and we talked about this last night on Press Pass, we actually had a graphic which showed the last 7 seasons for the Detroit Red Wings and the Vegas Golden Knights, And it looked a little funny on the screen because it was 7 years for Detroit and only six for Vegas, because that first year they were not in existence yet. But in that span, Vegas had so many more points and wins. And even with one less year of competition, this is an expansion franchise against one of the most storied names in hockey, and it hadn't been close.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? You know, here it is, a team that really wasn't in existence back then is all of a sudden, you know, playing it for the second time in the Stanley Cup Finals. And, you know, this is one of the things that I found as I was looking more into this. You know, the Golden Knights have won their last 32 playoff games, you know, when they score at least three goals, including 12-0, you know, in such games this playoff run. It's the longest streak in the playoffs since Montreal won 41 straight between 64 and 71. That's how far back you got to go.
Wow.
Yeah. But then, you know, on the other hand, the Panthers. Think about this. You know, the route that they've taken to get to where they are. They're the first team in NHL history to face four of the NHL's five highest-seeded teams from the regular season. You know, Boston, Carolina, and then Vancouver.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just an amazing story of what's happened with this team, you know, in terms
Vancouver,
of...
Vancouver, right?
Vegas, yes.
Yeah.
So, it's just amazing. The Panthers, you know, we thought they were left for dead when they played Boston, and, you know, there's no way they're going to beat Boston. Well, surprisingly, they came out of that series, and they've just moved along and, you know, come up with some late-minute heroics in a few games. That
beat the Maple Leafs. That was interesting to see. Now the streak for Canadian teams to go without a Stanley Cup is at 210 and counting.
Wow. Who would have
seven
thought that?
Teams from Canada over 30 years. So 210 chances.
Unbelievable.
And not one championship. I want to switch, if we can, to the NBA. And we're going to get to the Tigers. Trust me. I know a lot of people are saying, why are you spending all this time on the NBA and the NHL? But a lot of people are paying close attention, and Bob Trippi has broken down some amazing numbers. When you look at these teams and Nikola Jokic, he talked about the fact that when he scores over 40 points, that's not necessarily a good thing for Denver.
No. As a matter of fact, you know, that was kind of, I think, the key thing in last night's game was the fact that they kind of made him a little more one-dimensional in a sense, and it took away his ability to pass the ball. I think he finished, four assists? They're 0-3 when, you know, Jokic scores 40 points because he had 41 last night. And meanwhile, they're 13-1 when he scores fewer than 40. So those three losses in 40-point games are tied for the most by any player in postseason NBA history.
Wow. Who's that tied with?
Oh, boy. I don't remember who it was, but that's probably a safe guess if I were guessing anybody when you think about all the big scores and, you know, playoff history and that. But, yeah, I don't remember off the top of my head. So,
right.
It's interesting how Miami came out last night, and it reminded me a lot of the Detroit Pistons when they had the Bad Boys because of the way they played the defense. And it's like you almost would count them out in a sense, but then they turn up the defense and they get those baskets from, you know, whoever. And it just, it wasn't just Butler last night, you know, it was spread out among the team. And
the guys off the bench played a major role. And Gabe Vincent, I mean, you look at him and you wonder, you know, it's like looking at a JV player in high school. Compared to the varsity guys, and he comes out there and couldn't miss.
No, exactly. So, and you look at last night's game, you know, it was the Heat's seventh double-digit comeback win of the season, and that's tied for the most such wins in a single postseason in the last 25 years. You basically got to go back to the Warriors last season and the Heat back in 2011 and 2012.
So if Miami goes down by 10 or more, that's a good thing for Heat fans.
basically, it seems like it, you know. I mean, you hate to be in that position, but it doesn't seem to, you know, cause an issue with this team. They're a team that, you know, and I know the announcers say it a lot on the telecast about the fact that you got so many undrafted guys there. The pieces work. The coaching works. They know what they're doing, and they don't panic, you know, if they get down by double digits. You know, they have a method of coming back, and that's kind of the way the Pistons were, the Bad Boys, you know, that they – and I hate to keep dwelling on that, but that's what it reminds me of, having covered them and then watching these guys. You know, I've never been a Heat fan, but in watching them, it's like, don't count them out. They were down by, what, 15 last night, I think, at one point?
Yeah, 15.
You know, they took control in the fourth quarter, and, you know, I know that Denver had an opportunity to win it or tie it at the buzzer, but at that point, you don't want to have to go for a three-point shot in order to send the game into overtime. So it's just it's amazing, the series. You know, you look at it, you know, with the Nuggets and the Heat playing for the title, this is the first time in over 40 years, and just the sixth time ever, that the NBA will have five different champions over a five-season span.
So no repeat champions in a five-year period.
You've
got five
correct.
Different teams have won
in
the 5 years. And everyone talks about the dynasties. People like to focus on dynasties. And the Lakers and the Celtics and the Bulls with the two three-peats separated by Michael's sojourn into baseball. But I like this much better. I don't like dynasties, and I don't like repeat champions. And the fact that you have, in this case, Toronto, right, won it.
Right.
And then L.A., the Bucks, last year Golden State. So you're right. That's 5 years in a row with a different champion, regardless who wins.
So you got to go back to 1977 to 1981 to find the last time that happened. And that's when you had the Portland Trailblazers, the Washington Bullets. I think they were still – were they the Washington Bullets or were they the Baltimore Bullets at the time?
They were the Washington Bullets. With
Washington Bullets.
So, yeah.
Okay. And then you had the Seattle Supersonics.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the Lakers with Magic Johnson.
Right.
And then you had the Celtics in 81.
Right.
Yeah, it's only like I said, it's only happened this is the sixth time. It's happened, you know, five times before, and you know, you'd think that in the past that there would have been, you know, more of these, you know, in the old days, you know, just because of the fact that, you know, they didn't have as many superstars. I mean, yeah, you had Will Chamberlain and you know, some of those guys, but it's just amazing. You know, you look at it and people say, well, why has it lasted so long? And in this case, you know, you got superstars dominating in basketball in a way that they just don't do it in other sports. I mean, look back in the 80s. You had Bird, Magic, and Kareem Jabbar. You know, then you had Jordan, who won six in the 1990s. And then in the 2000s, you had Kobe, Shaq, and Tim Duncan, who won eight. And then in this last decade, just, you know, wrapped up, you had LeBron, Dwayne Wade, Steph Curry, and Kevin Durant, who won six. So it's, you know, quite a feat when you start naming some of those names and you look who they are. And, you know, the wild stat that, you know, I pointed out to you was that since the last time the NBA saw five champions in five seasons, it's happened 22 times in Major League Baseball and nine times each in the NFL and NHL. So you can kind of see where, you know, there's quite a big difference there. So
there was actually a period, Bob, and I think your research points this out, from 1975 through 1981, that's a seven-year period, not a five-year period, when there was no repeat champion.
Correct.
That's amazing that could be. But, you know, you talk about what's different, why in the NBA. You've got international players. You've got some other changes in the game. It seems like the changes have been a little more revolutionary. And, for example, the three-point shot. And when you see a team get out in front of it, it's almost like it takes other teams a little bit of time to catch up. And they do, eventually. Now, you know, everyone is doing that. But you talk about the NBA Finals and the great players, even though Nikola Jokic was a two-time MVP, and a lot of people think should have been a three-time MVP, but Joel Embiid won the award. We don't have an all-NBA first-team selection in the finals.
So for the first time since 1990, you know, we do not have a single all-NBA player. And that, you know, that's going all the way back to when the Pistons were playing the Trailblazers, if you recall. And, you know, I had the list, and I had to go through it twice just to make sure I was right. And, you know, the closest was, you know, Jason Tatum, who made the first team, you know, was the streak's last hope. So if Boston would have won that series with Miami, you know, it would have been, you know, still intact and everything. But, yeah, there's no first teamers. You got two second teamers on there in Jimmy Butler and Jokic. So, yeah, it goes to show that, you know, the way things are with the NBA, just look at the stats themselves. You had a record 43 players who averaged at least 20 points this season. You know, that's incredible. Either you're not playing a lot of defense or you got a lot of guys that can shoot the ball pretty darn good, you know?
It's not that the scoring totals have gone up that much, if at all. But what's happened, Bob, is that there isn't as much balanced scoring within a team. You used to see that most winning teams in NBA games had at least four players in double figures. Yeah. Now, it's not always that way. I've seen teams win games by double figures, and they've only had two players in scoring double figures.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, there are, you know, some times where I use one of those online betting applications and all that, and they would have things in there and say, so-and-so over is 25 points, and you just know that player is probably going to do it on that team just because he scores a hell of a lot of points, you know. And but if you look at the rest of the team, you know, they'd have the other players on there and they'd be 12 points, 15 points, you know, just not anywhere near. And, yeah, you see a lot of that. I mean, even the Pistons had some situations like that this year and last year where they had guys that were just so far and above everybody else in terms of their points and everything, you know, for a stretch of games. And meanwhile, the rest of the team, well, that's kind of why you didn't win very many games.
Someone said, what is the lesson to be learned from this postseason? Is it the upsets? It's at eighth seeds. What is it? And I said, I think it's if you get the chance, you should go into business with Stan Kroenke.
And, Bob, a lot of people might be surprised by the double here that South Florida is on the verge of completing, an underdog in both these series. But if the Heat and the Panthers can pull this off, what does it mean?
Well, it would make Miami the first city/metro area to have NBA and NHL champions in the same year.
First one.
Yep, five cities. Five cities, metro areas, have made it to the NBA and NHL finals in the same year. And none of them have actually accomplished the goal of winning, you know, in the same year. I mean, you had the Celtics and the Bruins, you know. I'm sure Rob is back to say, yeah, I know, the Celtics and the Bruins, back in 57, 58, and 74. Then you had the New York Knicks and Rangers in 72 and 94. Then you had the Philadelphia 76ers and Flyers in 1980. Then you had the Chicago Bulls and Blackhawks in 92. And then the last time that an area had that opportunity were the Nets and the Devils, back in 2003. And well, the only one who's come
20 years since a metro area has even gotten two teams into the final.
Exactly. And, you know, the amazing part about the thing is years ago, the one that came the closest was New York. And that was, you know, the Rangers won the Stanley Cup in 94, but then the Knicks lost the NBA Finals in seven games to the Rockets. And I believe, wasn't that the Knicks team that was an eight seed? They were the lesser seed. I want to say they were an eighth seed, and they made it all the way to the finals, but they lost in the finals, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
You're talking about 94?
94, yeah. I'm pretty sure it was the 94
seed. The Rangers
seed.
Won. That was Mark Messier.
Correct. And
I
then the Knicks.
Very clearly.
Yeah, because the Knicks, you know, there was no way anybody was expecting the Knicks, you know, back in 94 to go to the NBA Finals. And
they lost to Houston. That was
Houston.
Patrick Ewing and Hakeem Olajuwon.
Yep. Yep.
You know, I'll never forget that, Bob, because I was covering the World Cup. Don't ask me why, but I was. I was part of a coverage team for Gannett. And we're down at the Silver Dome. Or they're playing on the grass indoors, the first time that had ever been done, all those trays that had been developed at Michigan State. So we're watching, while we're covering soccer, the NBA finals, and O.J. Simpson and the slow speed chase at the same time. And this was a Sunday night. I remember seeing, you know, they've got the basketball, and then they have the quarter panel where you could see them both, you know, the picture in picture. But it was surreal to see that, and it didn't work out very well for the Knicks. But what about the Grand Slam? And we always hear about which city or metropolitan area has had the most success, but there aren't many that have won championships in every sport.
Well, if the Panthers win a title, it would make Miami the ninth city or metro area with championships in four major sports. You know, as you may know, the Heat have three titles, the Dolphins have two, and the Marlins have two. So when you look at the other cities that do have titles, you know, in four major sports, that would be New York. Back in 1970, you had the Knicks. Philadelphia had the Flyers in 74, Detroit with the Pistons in 89, Chicago had 1991 Bulls, Boston the 2001 Patriots, Los Angeles the 2012 Kings, and in D.C. you had the Capitals in 2018, and St. Louis you had the Blues in 2019.
So what other cities even have all four major pro sports?
Yeah,
most
great question.
Don't have, there's one that they're missing.
Let's see. I'm trying to think here who would be the one that we would be thinking about here. Cause
Minnesota.
You're looking, well, yeah.
Minneapolis has all four, right?
Yeah, they have all four.
Milwaukee does not. Indianapolis
no.
does not. Pittsburgh
no,
does not.
No.
Buffalo does not. Most of them do not. So Miami, but Miami's pretty new to this party too. A lot of these teams
exactly.
are fairly new.
Yeah, you'd have to. What about? Well, no, Houston doesn't. I was going to say Houston would be one. Phoenix. Yeah, Phoenix would be one, but because they have four teams. You got the Diamondbacks, if you want to count them as the Phoenix metropolitan area.
What about Dallas?
Yeah, Dallas would be another one. Well, would you count the Rangers
Stars,
in Dallas?
The Cowboys, the Texas Rangers. Sure, they're in Dallas. They're in Arlington,
yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah. There's not many more areas that you could really, you know, put a finger on and say, yeah, they'd have an opportunity to do this. So it's kind of a rare thing if you look at it.
I want to switch gears here, Bob, and talk some baseball, right? A lot of people waiting to get a take on the Tigers and one of the most bizarre weekends I can recall for the Tigers. It starts out in Chicago, a team that Detroit had won 3 out of 4 the previous weekend in Detroit. Now they're going to meet again a week later. And Tigers start out with Reese Olson. Minor league call up, one of those guys, you know, the manager holds his nose and throws him out there and said, well, we're going to throw this guy out there and, you know, we'll just take our L, basically. And he's got ERA and sixes or sevens in the minors. Comes out there, he throws 5 innings of no-hit ball. He's the first Tiger to do that in his major league debut in 51 years. And the Tigers still managed to lose the game. So now you get to Saturday, right? And, well, White Sox are there in extra innings. They've got bases loaded. And Tigers look like, you know, hey, they can get out of this and they have a great chance. And it's the only time that there was a game where all three runs, a game with 3 or more runs, and they all came on wild pitches. Every run scored on a wild pitch. There are only 10 times in baseball history where there had been a game with 3 or more runs where there wasn't an RBI. And, Bob, I love this one. It was also the only time when a game ended and the last contact was not with a player's bat or with a glove or with a hand.
Was it not the most bizarre game you ever saw in your life?
Yeah.
I mean, I was sitting there watching it. First of all, the Tigers, I thought you have a runner on second base and they're going to bunt to try to get him over to third.
Yeah.
And, of course, we didn't see any of the players that went up to bat try to bunt the ball to try to advance the runner. And, you know, I know that AJ Hinch, you know, ended up explaining it later that when you're on the road, bunting isn't always the preferred method and all that.
But Why?
I don't understand that.
If you can bunt at home, you can bunt on the road.
I totally agree. It was not explained, and nobody asked the follow-up question of why. And that's
because
that
you don't have the last at bat.
I guess I don't know the lines of thinking. I could tell you the lines of thinking more in terms of for football, but for baseball, some of these are head scratchers in my mind because I'm like, what the heck are they thinking? You know, do they have a chart that says
nobody
you're on
asked
the road?
Them to clarify that?
No, I didn't hear it in the post game. He just, you know, the way he explained it was, you know, when you're on the road, you know,
when the ball hit the umpire right in the face, and obviously he went down, you know, catcher there, he's like, oh, is he hurt? What's the deal? Where's the ball? Eric Haas couldn't find the ball.
Right.
Meanwhile, you know, here comes, it was Eloy Jimenez, comes in and scores a winning run. Broadcasters didn't know what was going on. Jason Benetti and Steve Stone and the White Sox broadcast, it took them a while to figure it out. I don't know if Benetti's figured it out yet. And so game is over, and we come to yesterday. And Tigers are, again, in position to win, but White Sox come back, and now, you know, you bring in Alex Lang, and you figure is your most reliable pitcher, your best player this season, your most likely all-star, and all he does is give up a grand slam home run to a guy who had never hit one.
Jake Berger. Yep, broke a 2-2 tie. Yeah, you get the script for this weekend, you just wouldn't believe it. I mean, here's, you look at the weekend before and how they dominated the White Sox, and then they go over to the south side of Chicago, and it was just, just a disaster. I mean, they scored three runs in the entire series, and only two were driven in with a hit. And that was Spencer Torkelson's two-run homer in the fourth inning Sunday. So if you look at it, the Tigers have scored six runs total in the four games since Riley Green and Matt Durling went out on the injury list. So production is a problem. And you know, let's think about this, you know, from a broad perspective here. Remember, on May the 28th, that they were one game behind Minnesota for the lead in the division. They are 1-5 since. And now, this is the stat of all stats. Their schedule over the remainder of this month, they've got the next 23 games, 17 are against first-place teams. You got seven against the Twins, four against the Rangers, three against the Braves, and three against the Diamondbacks. So is it going to get better? Boy, if it is, somebody better tell me how, you know, are they trading for somebody or what's going on? I just saw something. I was just reading the transaction wire, and I see that the Tigers have now called up nine starters this year, nine starting pitchers this season. And you remember last season, heck, I think they had, wasn't it like around 16 or 17 different starting pitchers that they had to call up at one time? We're already at nine, and we're in the early part of June. It's a problem. It's a problem, and you know, the good part is you got Tarek Skubal who did throw two scoreless innings, you know, in his first rehab start yesterday. So you know, hopefully he can get well enough here soon that they could bring him up, because right now we're going to see what they have down in the minors, and I'm not exactly sure that it's going to be what they need. I mean, pitching has not been bad, the starters and everything lately.
No, the pitching has been surprisingly good.
Yes.
Considering, you figure, if you had that many injuries on a staff, the pitching would be an abomination. You know, the Tigers have actually allowed, catch this, five fewer runs than the Dodgers, and seven fewer runs than the Diamondbacks, and LA and Arizona are the co-leaders in the NL West, which is a pretty good division. The problem is not with the pitching. This is one of the worst hitting teams you will ever see. Detroit has scored 207 runs. That is one run more, the second worst in baseball, by the way.
Right.
It's one run more than Oakland. Oakland has 206 runs, and Oakland's on pace to finish 32-130, the worst team in baseball history, and they've only scored one fewer run than the Tigers.
Well, I hate to say it, but the high point for the Tigers this season, you know, because some of these guys aren't going to be back until July, the high point might have been May 28th when they got that close to first place, because now it's a tough schedule from here on out, you know, the remainder of this month. And, you know, it's not looking good is the best way to put it.
But normally when you say a team was one game from first place, you think, well, you know, they must have had a really good year. I think back to 1961 when I was growing up and the Tigers won 101 games and didn't make the postseason. But in this case, it's not that the Tigers were one game out of first. They were still one game from being 500.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
So they just happened to be in a crappy division that every team in the AL East, you know, hey, you can look at 11 teams in baseball would be leading that division.
Isn't that amazing? There's going to be no wild card that's going to come out of that division.
Oh,
there's just no way. Whoever comes out of that division, and most likely it's probably going to be the Twins, the way it's looking right now when you look at, you know, the other teams in that division. You know, it's we had a good run. You know, I mean, yeah, they could come back after the All-Star break and maybe make up a little bit, but they're going to be, I just have a funny feeling they're going to be so far down in the standings that, you know, I think any pipe dreams that people had of this team maybe contending into September, I just don't see it. You know, I know funny things have happened, but I'd be willing to go out on a limb and say, I just don't see it with this team because they're just being socked with injuries. And, you know, tonight they go on the road to Philadelphia. So, which is not an easy place to play.
Philadelphia's been a big disappointment.
Yes, they have.
Trey Turner's been terrible. And he was the number one player in fantasy baseball this year before the season. And when he picked him up from the Dodgers, everyone thought, man, now how do you stop the Phillies? Philadelphia can't get out of their own way. But, when they get the Tigers, they might get well.
That's true. That is true.
You know, so, I have a theory on this, Bob, an idea. And some people say, well, yeah, maybe there's some argue with me, but I actually came up with this back when Seattle in the NFL won its division, and I think they were 7-9. I don't think a team that's below 500 should be in the postseason. If they win their division and they're below 500, then they should add another wild card team because there's going to be another team. You know, in baseball, let's say if Minnesota ganked in as the champ in the American League Central and they were 80-82. There's going to be a wild card team with 95 wins that's not going to get in. So I say, yeah, you win your division, you get in, but if you're not above 500, you vacate that spot.
Well, you just look at the AL East. You've got all those teams. All five teams are above 500. So, you know, even the Yankees are in third place, and they're 11 games over 500. So then you look at Minnesota, which is leading the division. They're only two games over 500. So now's the time to see, I guess, them beat each other up, the black and blue division of the AL Central. You know, it's just so much for parity, you know.
And one more thing here I wanted to hit on baseball, and then I want to touch on college football very quickly. You had a story about Roger Craig, right, the former pitcher with the Dodgers and the Mets, and then a very trusted coach under Sparky Anderson. Sparky really relied on Roger Craig a lot because Sparky wasn't a pitching guy.
And yeah, he –
You had you covered the Tigers in those years.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, my first year as a reporter with UPI, I got to actually cover the 84 Tigers that season, and it was, you know, it was kind of a baptism for me, and I didn't know very much about the Tigers at the time because I hate to admit this in public, but I was a Yankees fan, you know, up until. Yeah, exactly.
We used to like him, Rob. I don't know. We're going to have to cut his time.
Well, anyways, so I got to do some features. And one of the features was about the pitching and everything. And so I got to talk to Roger Craig. The guy was really super nice. I mean, he would explain things to you in layman's terms. He didn't care who you were or whatever. And, you know, it was kind of funny because we kept hearing about the split finger fastball.
Yeah.
And so one of the times I was there early enough. I always would get to the games early, and he was sitting towards the end of the bench and everything, and everybody was over there talking to Sparky and everything like that. And I wandered over to him, and I was asking more about the split finger, and he was showing me how to do it and everything. And so he came out of the dugout, and this is in Tiger Stadium. He came out of the dugout, and we're on the side there. He says, "Throw it to me." And I threw the thing, and the thing just was, oh, my God, it was ugly. It was just totally ugly. He says, it's like a fork ball. And he says, you know, that's what you got to think of. You know what a fork ball is.
It's not,
yeah. I said, no, I've never thrown a fork ball because I'm, you know, kind of young and all that. And so he's showing up. didn't have to do that. But, you know, I asked, and I was the only one over there. I was the only one over there talking to him.
I probably appreciate the fact that you would ask. And,
It was the big thing then. You know, that was the big pitch back then, was the split figure and teaching Jack Morris and Dan Petrie and all those guys. And looking back, you know, I'll have to see if I still have the story I did, because it was just really an amazing thing for that guy to actually take the time and show me something like that.
You know, Bob, I have actually had some positive experiences with the following coaches and managers: Bob Knight, Bill Belichick, Greg Popovich, and a lot with Jim Leland, none of whom are considered media friendly. In fact, a lot of them would scare media members away. But if you engage them and you ask an intelligent question, sometimes they will give you the best answer you could ever get, because they don't get many questions. So many media members are intimidated that they don't get that. Greg Popovich, the bus was waiting while he was telling me about certain things. And, you know, it wasn't because he knew who I was. It's just every once in a while, and that's probably what happened with Roger Craig, and he said, you know what? This guy asks, he cares. Well, nobody else does. I'm going to spend a little time with this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just so strange. And here, look, you know, I felt kind of embarrassed because I'm out there throwing a ball to this guy, and, you know, I look like a total idiot when it went flying in the wrong direction. So I'm like, okay. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. Some of these coaches, you know, I still say to this day the two best that I ever had a relationship with in terms of being able to talk with them, and, you know, it would be Darryl Rogers. But, you know, he would chat with me, and he knew that I went to Michigan State and everything. Yeah. And the other was Wayne Font. You know, when I covered the Lions, you know, at training camp, he used to always sit in a golf cart with his buddy, one of the other assistant coaches. And there's the time he told me to come over and sit in the cart with him, and we were just chatting about stuff. And
Wayne Font was like George Perlis. He loved that part of the job. And if you didn't talk to him or ask him questions or come see him, he wondered what was wrong. But you mentioned Darryl Rogers. Before we go, Bob, the College Football Hall of Fame ballot every year, and if you're a member of the Football Writers Association of America, plug for people to join, you can vote for that. And three Spartans on the ballot this year, right?
Yeah. You got Flozell Adams, who was a tackle. And he was back in the 90s, 97, I think it was. You have Mark D'Antonio, and you have Darryl Rogers, who is a coach. But then there's one more person you left out, and that's, you know, Gideon Smith. Gideon Smith is also on the ballot, too. He's in he's on the
Michigan
ballot.
State's first black player.
He is on the ballot in the divisional coaching category, because remember he coached at Hampton University, and
I didn't even
he led them to the 1922 Black College National Championship.
Wow, I did not even see that. That's great.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah, certainly a place in Spartan lore, going back to the teens, but we're talking 110 years ago. Of those three, which do you think will get into the College Football Hall of Fame first? Darryl's been on the ballot a long time. It seems like if it was going to happen, it might happen, and now he's passed. So, he's not going to be in the news anymore. But D'Antonio, just on the ballot, and Flozell's been on for a while. What do you think?
Well, if I'm guessing, I have a funny feeling it might be Mark D'Antonio. And the reason I say it is fresh in people's minds. He's well respected out there, you know, among the writers and everything. And it's fresh in people's minds of what he's done.
Right.
If I were to place a bet, I'd probably say it'd probably be him.
I think you're right, Bob. This was fun. I'm glad we got to do a longer segment. I can't tell you how many weeks when we do this, we're done, and then I say, Oh, the commercial break. I forgot to ask Trippy about this. You know, it was always trying to get 10 pounds into a 5-pound bag. So I'm glad we got a little extra time today to do this.
Yeah, it was fun. And, you know, you did ask me a question before we go. You asked me about Stan Kroenke, about becoming the first owner. Yeah.
Right.
He is the owner of the Nuggets, and he's 3 wins away from becoming the first owner to win 3 titles in 3 major North American sports.
Okay.
And he would have won.
The Avalanche?
Yep, exactly. And if he wins, if the Nuggets win, he will have done everything in a span of just 16 months.
Wow. Okay, well, he also owned the Rams when they were in St. Louis, but he didn't own them when they won the championship back from here, right? Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Bob, thanks so much. We'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good.